Welcome to Radio Entrepreneurs. I'm Jonathan Friedman, joined in the studio today with Gary Fertig. Gary, how are you?
I'm well. Always good to be here. And very interesting guest, a repeat offender, as they say. Eric Sildman from Easton Capital, Easton Capital Real Estate Fund. Eric, welcome.
Thank you very much, Gary.
So what's going on today in the world of real estate?
Well, it's been a busy time. It's been probably 3 or 4 years now where there's been more and more interest for investors to invest in apartments, to invest in rental property. It's an area of investments where there are cash flows and good returns, and it's an area where the banks and national lenders continue to lend money, unlike some of the other commercial real estate areas, maybe shopping centers, retail, or office buildings where it's tougher, continues to be difficult to get a loan, largely because of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, HUD, banks, et cetera, and their experience being very successful lending to that environment. It's a very active lending environment. You can borrow money at very low rates. Cash flow is there. We create yield that investors are looking for much more than you can get out of a bank or many other areas. So
Excellent.
It's a good time.
So for the benefit of our listeners, just give an overview of what Easton Capital does.
Sure, Jonathan. So we raise capital into specific funds. We've raised 3 funds over the last 6 years. The current fund that we're investing is a little over $50 million. We manage a total of about $100 million. The first and second funds are fully invested. So we raise money primarily from high net worth individuals. They commit capital to the fund. Then we go out and look for properties to buy in through the fund. And we focus on the apartment market. We look for typically suburban garden-style apartments. They're all over the country. There's literally millions and millions of units, and they're everywhere. And we buy those with local joint venture partners that are local to those markets, put skin in the game, and manage the properties.
And is there a particular geographic footprint that you look for? Or?
We look all over the United States. We've pretty much looked at transactions in every state of the country. The majority of the properties that we own are kind of in the middle of the country. We own quite a bit in Texas, number of markets in Texas. We also own as north as Minnesota and as south as Mississippi. We've looked at many of the coastal markets, especially areas like New York, Boston, San Francisco, tend to be too high price for us. We can't buy at a low enough price to get a high enough return to make sense for our business.
And very often these are properties who have taken some impact in the marketplace or have in need of an upgrade, so to speak.
Right. So I'd say we're value investors in that we buy stuff that has some type of distress. We typically look for one or more of three types of distress. Physical distress, that's the easiest one. You know, something's broken physically, but also managerial distress where they're not well managed, or financial distress from the owner where oftentimes they paid too much for it and they just can't afford the property.
Need to get out.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And is there a typical profile or size, number of units that you guys are operating in?
On average, I'm going to say 200 units, 250 units would be the average size property. We typically
say they're fairly significant.
Yeah, they are fairly significant. Our smallest properties are, I think 50 or 60 units. Our largest property is 700 units. Over 700 units.
So again, typically you don't go for high rises. They're typically garden apartments.
They're correct. Mid-rise and high-rise, typically you're going to find that in urban areas or near into suburban areas. We typically go a little further out, a little more suburban, where land is typically cheaper, mm-hmm. and where you have a complex of multiple buildings. Some of these properties have 20 or 30 buildings on them, each with 8, 10, 12 units per building.
And is there a specific reason why that kind of a building versus the high-rise? What's the...
There are expenses to run high rises that force the rents to be higher. There's also, it's a different cost basis to run a building like that.
Where I'm assuming in your type of apartment, but no elevators, yeah, not a lot of common areas, things of that nature.
Correct. There is typically no elevators, or if it is, it's a simple elevator that goes up one or two flights. Mm-hmm. So you don't have, you know, more, you know, cost to do that.
You trade off the HVAC guys for the landscaper.
Fair enough. We do that. And I will tell you that we see a lot of deals in urban areas. We've looked at, I'll give you an interesting trend, and you're hearing about it in Boston here, but we haven't seen it. We haven't looked into it deeply in Boston, but we have looked into it in Chicago, for example, which is these micro units. So the idea of a 250 or 300 square foot unit. And, you know, if you take a, for example, we looked at a property in Chicago, which was a very famous historic hotel, not in the urban core of Chicago, but in a kind of very near in urban Chicago. And they were going to kind of revive the building and make it into these small micro units. Our opinion was that it may work in small doses, but that when we called a dozen or so people in their 20s and asked them in Chicago, because we did the kind of groundwork to say, well, will this work? A lot of them said, look, we don't want to live in 250 square feet. I lived in something like that for 6 months and I had to get out. And so I think that if Mayor Menino is listening, I think it's a lovely idea to have micro units, but you got to understand that the turnover in those units will be very high and it'll be a difficult management task.
Well, I think it obviously appeals to a certain segment of the population. You're seeing it, I think, in higher end condos. But I'm again making an assumption here. These people must be traveling a lot and used to living out of hotels.
Yeah,
and you know, it's not the place you want to come home and kick your feet up and look at the wall.
I think you're right. And where I think actually we've seen some stuff that's a little more interesting to us is units that get more near 450 to 500 square feet. So I wouldn't call them the super micro units, but they are the small units. And then you could probably, someone that does travel a lot, it still makes sense for them, but it's not just so small that you're literally pulling your bed down from the wall.
I was going to say that you have to fold up your bed in the morning.
Right.
Yeah, well, they also have adult bunk beds. Who's that furniture store that, you know, you put it all together yourself? My daughter has a small apartment in Manhattan. And we considered this, because the bedroom basically fits the bed. So an adult
right.
bunk bed.
Well, look, that's yeah. that's what you get. And because we don't own a lot in urban kind of core markets, we see less of that.
That's not true.
Although, but if we could find a deal that made financial sense for us, we'd probably do it.
Looking at your website, one of the things I know is you say you target B and C properties in A and B locations. We fix properties, not neighborhoods. You know, it makes a lot of sense.
Thank you. We feel that this is an expensive business. We're spending, even on relatively small properties, many millions of dollars. And it's not our job to fix neighborhoods. I do think that when we improve a property, the current residents are happy that we're doing that. Some of them are less happy because when we start fixing things, we often raise their rents.
Sure.
That's necessary to compensate us for doing that work. But we aren't looking in the, you know, fanciest markets. We don't buy in those markets because we aren't getting as much return on our investment. And so we're buying in the more suburban or secondary or tertiary markets, number one. And number two, which are more typically the B or C markets, but we don't want to be in the rough part of town.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine you're obviously not running into rent control issues in those buildings either, or those markets, in all likelihood.
Correct.
So you have opportunities to increase your rent roll and
correct.
And such.
I'll tell you this, Jonathan. There are fewer and fewer rent control markets in the country. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of change, you know, as you know, in the last 20 years, 30 years. But where we do run in, so our typical property is what we consider a market rate unit, where there are no restrictions exactly on what you have to rent for. That said, we do own some properties that are under the lower income housing tax credit, or LIHTC, deal. And with that, residents are income restricted. So you can rent for as much as you can rent for, but you can only rent it to people
that meet a certain
qualification. And of course, if you're making X dollars and the rents are very high, you can't afford to live there. So it does put us in a position where we do deliver housing to people that don't make as much money.
So curious aspect of your business, as you said, a lot of your acquisitions are far and wide spread across the country. Due diligence process. Are you guys getting out and inspecting the properties yourselves? Do you work with a team, a local team? How do you go through that process?
Right, that's a great question. So we only invest with local joint venture operating partners. We clearly do our own due diligence, but let me make two comments on this point. First off, 15, 20 years ago in the real estate business, when you got a deal, the first thing you did was get on a plane and go walk around and look at it and talk to people. At this point in time for us and in our strategy, it's frankly the last thing we do. The first thing we'll do is get on the internet and we'll use Google Maps and we'll make sure that the property is not sitting next to a large landfill or a dump. For real.
Right.
Because they often are.
The next thing we'll do is we'll go to, and these are all frankly free services, we'll go to the Census Bureau reports and look at both, you know, who's living there at what, at one demographics. Exactly. We'll look at demographics and you can get updated information. We have found numerous different interesting sites of people that rank. There's one recently, and I don't remember the name of the site, but they've gone through and ranked all 600 metropolitan areas, if there's such a thing, for kind of quality of living and this and that. So we go down to that level. Many other kinds of sites. We look at rent.com to look at comparable rents of other properties, or even rent.com to look at the rent of our property and see, are the people that are sending it to us telling us what's really happening?
Is it a really accurate reflection of
so
what's going on?
There's a tremendous amount of information that you can find online. The second thing is that because we only work with local joint venture partners, these are the guys that know those markets. These are the people that know the brokers in those markets. The brokers want to go to the local guys typically to sell the property because there's a higher likelihood that it'll close. These are repeat buyers from the brokers. So when the brokers go seek to sell a property, they typically would love to sell it to the local buyer because that's a repeat customer. Maybe somebody from out of town comes in and lobs in a big price, but that's not the bread and butter of the brokers that sell these properties. So so we realize we sit in Boston, and frankly, I'll get a call sometime from another guy in Boston that says, hey, I got this great deal in Memphis, Tennessee. What do you think? And I'll say, well, what I think is that you should be sitting in Memphis, Tennessee.
So the dynamics in the market has changed dramatically. I'd imagine you guys can look at a lot more deals that way.
We can look at a lot more deals that way. And we can look at a lot more deals that way. And also, we can leverage the experience of our operating partners. Let me back up and tell you that we've talked to hundreds, maybe now 300, 400 different operating partners across the country. We've invested with five. Mm-hmm. So one of the... if you think about the funnel of our investment strategy, the easy part is figuring out if the property is a good investment. The harder part is being in business with the right partners that know their markets. And I think this is true in many, many businesses, certainly in many types of real estate businesses, is having the right partners.
Absolutely.
No doubt about it. Definitely, in terms of making, you know, having a profitable business, you got to be embedded with the right people.
Eric, you talked about some shifts, dynamics in the market over the last couple of years with rents increasing and how that's impacted your business. You want to share that a little bit?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Backing up even before we had spoken earlier, rents started rising and occupancies and vacancies started falling, I should say, probably back in 2010 before other parts of the economy got going. We did a lot of purchasing of properties, distressed properties in 2011. That slowed down in 2012. And the reason it slowed down is rents were rising so fast and debt was so cheap that prices got bid up to a point where we didn't chase them. What I believe has happened in the last just couple, 3 months is that rents went up significantly. Markets like Boston and San Francisco, 10 or 15% per year, which is an unsustainable level. People now don't believe rents are going to go up as much over the next couple of years. They think they will continue to rise, but there's an issue where it's nice to have rents rising, certainly if you own property, but there's a price at which the residents can't pay the rent. It's too high. Mm-hmm. If it goes up 2 or 3 or 4% a year, in most cases, can a person pay an additional $25 or $50? Probably. Right. But can they pay an additional $200, $300? Right. Probably not.
With a continued soft economy and real wages not increasing, it's hard to hit people with that 10%, 15%.
Exactly. And little expectation of those real wages increasing. So that whole kind of super low inflation environment coupled with kind of people saying, wait a second, there's a breather. So how does that affect my business? Some of the sellers of the property, even the distressed sellers, are saying, you know, I think the prices are about as high as they're going to get. I don't think prices are going to keep going up. So they're bringing more property to market. More supply of property for sale helps me on the price side.
Right.
Good stuff. Well, it was a pleasure to have you in again. Good to hear the updates, and I appreciate you filling our listeners in on some new stuff. And if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way for people to reach you?
Sure. Our website is www.easthamcapital.com, EASTHAMCAPITAL.com. Check out the website. We're actually launching a brand new look of our website shortly. So if you check it out right away and then wait a month, and check it out again, it's going to look even better.
That sounds great. Well, a pleasure having you in, and we look forward to the next time as well, Eric.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back on Radio Entrepreneurs.